ladies and gentlemen, to our third hour of this edition of the Hagmann Report. We're going to be joined by Matt Bracken, a decorated U.S. Navy SEAL, in this third hour, and he's going to be with us just in just a few moments. But I want to bring your attention to an interesting piece that we were talking about during the last break here in the Hagmann Studios that has made its way to Drudge. Vegas shooter's girlfriend says he would lie in bed moaning and screaming. Mary Lou Danley, the woman investigators hoped would provide key details into the motive behind her boyfriend's deadly shooting attack, remembers him exhibiting symptoms such as lying in bed, moaning, and screaming, according to two former FBI officials who have been briefed on the matter. She said he would lie in bed, just moaning and screaming. Oh, my God, one of the former officials said.
Wow. You know, it sounds like night terrors, potential night terrors, Joe. And, you know, once in a while we have a segment where we get so much raw data that we just have to go back and review it the following day. And I think that hour two with our guest James Wesley Rawls was one of those segments. Some of the questions he asked were just so spot on. I want to see those tapes. I want to hear what's on the video and the audio as well, and I want to know what that note says. And I think that with 330 million Americans' hearts who have been that have been broken, and in many cases spirits that have been disheartened, I think we have a right to that information, and I think we have a right to that information sooner than later. But we've got Matt Bracken this hour, Joe, and he's been on the show several times before. Just a quality guest, and I would be remiss if I didn't remind our listeners, it was Matt Bracken who coined the term swamp lawyers last time he was with us, and we adopted that here at the Hagmann Report, and it's just so appropriate for these Comey, Mueller, and their ilk.
Matt, welcome back to the show.
Hello, how are you? What a week.
Yeah, what a week. What a week to have you back on, indeed. I guess let's start with the events in Las Vegas. Matt, why don't you tell us about just your overall assessment of the ordeal?
Well, you know, for months now I've been saying we're one magazine dump away from civil war, and I guess Sunday night was a more than one magazine dump, that's for sure. Full automatic, if you consider bump fire to be full automatic. In terms of the rate of fire, it certainly was. And firing into a penned-up crowd, that's a mass-murdering sniper's dream. You know, a fenced-in venue, something like 20 acres of 22,000 people that can't get out. I mean, that's literally shooting fish in a barrel or sardines in a can. Nowhere to go, nowhere to run.
Well,
go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Bracken. John Robertson sitting in for Doug Hagmann, who is investigating vis-a-vis the Northeast Intelligence Network, the tragedy in Las Vegas. But you and I have communicated together quite a bit through email. I produce the show. And right. I thought we would just jump right in the deep end, and we can sort of disseminate the Vegas issue, and we can go other places too if you like, but let's just remind our listeners and viewers right here and right now that your trilogy of books, Enemies, Foreign, and Domestic, there's three books, folks. It's Enemies, Foreign, and Domestic. Then there's Enemies, Foreign, and Enemies, Domestic. I've read all three books. I read them this past summer as I became acquainted with our guest, Matt Bracken. Matt, it's frightening and it's uncanny, and I've been dying to ask you this for 3 or 4 days now. The first chapter of the first book, which I believe is Enemies Foreign and Domestic, the one with the Gadsden flag motif.
Right. The yellow cover.
Yes, sir. You nailed it. I mean, I don't want to give away too much of the book, except to say that our previous hour guest was James Wesley Rawls. There are no two finer writers of preparedness, government overreach, dystopic fiction, what we sometimes call faction, then James Wesley Rawls and our three guests, Matt Bracken. Matt, you nailed it. I mean, chapter one of Enemies Foreign and Domestic, we've got a mind-controlled sniper in a partially built building creating a horrible mass casualty event at a football game. Matt, when exactly did you write that, and what inspired you to do so?
Well, I wrote it, actually I wrote it before 9/11/2001, but I, the 9/11 happened while I was writing it, so I was able to update it with, you know, instead of just ATF, it became Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. So it was right there during that time period. But you know, going back before 9/11, you know, to Waco and Ruby Ridge, I was watching the militarization of federal law enforcement. And when I was in SEAL Team, I had watched the early stages of SEAL Team 6 kind of go off the rails, going rogue a little bit under its first commanding officer. You know, where I saw that when you give people, you know, black credit cards, unaccountable, secret black fund accounts, it's a very strong temptation to kind of, you know, go off the rails and deal to yourself, especially when you can sort of, you know, you can instigate the entire process that will tend to make your own budget increase. You know, you can create the scenario and sort of, you know, deal your own cards. And I combined that with what I've been watching for decades, with especially the ATF, but also FBI, and came up with you know, a couple just mid-level rogue ATF agents who, after 9/11, were you know, kind of jealous that the FBI's budget was going through the stratosphere after 9/11, and ATF was still plodding along, you know, chasing biker gangs and, you know, low-level scum like that. For kind of piddling violations compared to what the ATF's, or compared to the FBI's mission and budget, you know, which was just flying through the roof. So they came up with the idea of firing into a stadium, you know, which creates a panic stampede. So in the novel, only 90 shots are fired into the stadium on opening day of the football season, but over 1,000 die in the subsequent panic stampede. You know, falling off the upper decks and getting jammed up in tunnels, things like that, which we kind of saw parallels to that. They haven't given the figures out in Las Vegas, but apparently there was quite a bit of stampeding and crushing. I don't know how many of the wounded were actually crushed rather than shot, but I suspect it's very significant. But it's they're all casualties. I mean, you know, panic is legit. I mean, panic is human dynamics. But I wrote that in you know, circa 2001, 2002. And my purpose with the novel was to try to get people to look beyond the overt narrative that will be pushed in the liberal mainstream media. In Enemies Foreign and Domestic, the overt narrative is, you know, right-wing militia kook with a beef against the federal government shoots into a stadium. He's killed by the SWAT team at the site where the sniper rifle is found. He didn't actually pull the trigger. He's out of it, too out of it. But, you know, the ATF guys then can go back and they create their own unit, the special training unit, a kind of a black ops ATF unit, which is given a mandate to go after these right-wing militia kooks by hook or by crook. And I don't want to give away too much of the novel, but about the first quarter of all of my novels are on my website, enemiesforeignanddomestic.com. So anybody is interested, the stadium massacre literally happens on page one of Enemies Foreign and Domestic. And after that novel, just staying in the theme of, you know, out of control federal law enforcement, we actually did see Operation Fast and Furious, which was literally an intentional mass murder scheme, except that it was conducted at a much higher level than a couple mid-level ATF bureaucrats. You know, Fast and Furious was operated right out of FBI headquarters and in Washington headquarters. We know that because it wasn't just ATF agents in Phoenix. It was ATF and FBI from, you know, from Florida to California doing this operation. And at the same time, both Eric Holder, the then Attorney General, and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton were both constantly, while Fast and Furious was in operation, but before it was disclosed, after the death of Agent Terry, they were on every TV show saying that 90% of the guns found at crime scenes in Mexico came from American gun stores. So they were all in on this false narrative. You know, before Benghazi, Hillary was up to her eyeballs in the false narrative that we need to get control of so-called assault rifles in the United States and the out-of-control gun stores and gun shows, because all of these guns, 90% of the murder scenes in Mexico involved American guns. It was a total lie. But they were literally sending the guns into Mexico by the car and truckload with no plan to track them, not telling federal law enforcement the Mexican federal law enforcement. Nobody in Mexico knew that this was happening. If it was a legit controlled operation, the Mexicans would have been on the other side of it. There was no attempt to in any way track these guns once they were out of sight of the ATF agents. They were literally trying to flood Mexico with American guns so that they could say, look, these guns came from these southwestern gun stores. It blew up in their face, but it was contained because the lying liberal mainstream media was willing to go along with the cover-up. I mean, when you think about it, back in Watergate, nobody died. It was a third-rate burglary. Nixon was forced to resign because of, you know, possibly being involved in the cover-up of a very low-level crime that he knew nothing about at the time. Yet, under Fast and Furious, 300 to 500 Mexicans were killed, and that was the purpose of the operation. They were killed on purpose. So it's far, far past the realm of fiction for anyone to say, Matt, you write, you know, crazy stuff that could never happen. Fast and Furious did happen. And that's why now, when we look at what the events in Las Vegas, nobody should look at the surface narrative and just say, well, hey, the FBI says we don't know why he did it. They wouldn't lie to us. Yeah, they would. They lie to us all the time. The whole McCabe, Mueller, Comey, that whole thing is, they're professional liars. You know, they are deep state swamp lawyers to the nth degree. They're up to their eyeballs in it. When they came out 3 hours after the shootings in Las Vegas and said, nope, no terrorism here, we can confirm there's no terrorism, bodies were still on the ground and they knew for a fact it wasn't terrorism. Well, I guarantee you there's no real estate probably on the planet outside of maybe the Pentagon and the White House that has more surveillance cameras, high-tech stuff, digital, all recorded. They can go back months. Every hallway, every stairwell. There's no voids in a Las Vegas hotel casino. There are no dead spaces. They can see right now who went up and down that hall for the days previous. And for the way that they're treating this, saying that they have no idea what the motive is, but they'll be sure and tell us when they figure it out. I look at this as a limited hangout or a slow roll. They know what the motive was. They know all about it. And I think that they're afraid that if they came out right now and said that it's either he was a Muslim convert or he was an Antifa, you know, hard left progressive at, you know, like the guy possibly at the anti-Trump rally in Reno on August 23rd, the guy wearing the pink NASA shirt. If they say that this guy is like the Scalise shooter, a hardcore lefty, you know, that his secret life was that he's a hardcore progressive, you know, communist-leaning guy or a Muslim convert, that the country will go ballistic. Instead, what they're trying to do is cement the false narrative that he's a white guy, that it's a racial thing. White men with a cache of guns, that's what the enemy is. You know, as if there's some, you know, genetic DNA evil that we contain. That's the narrative that they're trying to lay down and let solidify. Then they'll drib and drab out what they already know is the truth, because, you know, we've seen, for example, the receipt that came out showing two meals delivered to the room. That's only because somebody in the hotel staff, you know, went back and found the receipt and leaked it themselves. You can only imagine that the Las Vegas PD and the FBI have 10,000 times more information than that, including video of every single person going up and down that hallway second by second. And the reason that they're, you know, I can only imagine the reasons that they're not letting that information out, but none of the reasons look good to me.
Our guest this hour, for those just joining us, is Matt Bracken. And Matt Bracken has been with us several times before. He's really considered a Hagman Report favorite by everyone at Team Hagman as well as our audience. And just to be clear, Matt Bracken was a U.S. Navy SEAL, and he did do some work in Beirut and retired from the U.S. Navy in the 1980s. And again, I would be remiss having a not only a Navy man but a U.S. Navy SEAL on our program this evening without discussing just momentarily, Matt, the concept of false flags. Now, a lot of our listeners and viewers have a fairly cursory understanding of what a false flag is. I think some people might go back to the German-Polish border thing at the beginning of World War II, and they kind of understand that maybe you put on some other uniforms. But in fact, if I'm not mistaken, and I will defer to you, sir, false flag actually comes from naval warfare, does it not? It originated with the idea of a man of war flying another nation's flag until such time as the enemy closes in enough to blast them. So I was hoping that you could just take it from there. Talk to us a little bit about false flags. Also, you use the term limited hangout and slow roll. We've got a great audience. They're intelligent, and they love to learn this kind of stuff. Matt?
Well, first, I want to make a correction. I did not retire from the Navy. I was a junior officer in SEAL team, and after Beirut, I was looking at, you know, the rest of my career as a staff officer, which didn't, at the time, didn't interest me. I just wanted to be, you know, in a platoon, an operator, a shooter. After that, I had other goals, you know, mostly involving sailing and boats. So I left the Navy after my obligated service as a junior officer in the 80s. However, yeah, the slow roll and the limited hangout, it's a means of putting out damaging information. You were familiar with like the Friday afternoon data dump. You know, whether it's Clinton or whoever, when there's some damning amount of files that they know they have to put out, they put it out on Friday afternoon going into a busy weekend, preferably a holiday weekend. I think that's when the FBI called Hillary in to do her testimony. I think it was over like the 4th of July weekend or something like that. And so that you can control the dissemination of damaging information so that nothing hits in a solid wave like a tsunami, just a series of little ripples, you know, that can be dismissed. But, you know, as far as false flags, sure, that goes back to naval history. Also, you know, on the land also, I mean, you know, just to get within ambush range of an enemy to, you know, pretend that you're something that you're not. In terms of fomenting a civil war or an insurrection, you know, the side that really wants to start the war doesn't want to be seen in history as the aggressor. It's fairly rare for example, you know, Japan to just attack Pearl Harbor on Sunday morning. It's more typical to do what the Germans did and dress up in false flags so that they can spin out some false newsreels in order to portray themselves as the aggrieved and attacked party, which is now merely defending themselves. You know, the Soviets did it against, you know, the Finns, the Germans did it. It's very common. And something that, at Bill McIntosh down in South America, in old South America hand, he pointed out to me something called the, Bogotazo, which was the beginning of the period called La Violencia in Colombia in 1948 when a liberal, popular liberal presidential candidate was assassinated. What it looks like was a patsy, you know, some loser was put out being connected to the conservatives as his assassin, when in fact it was probably communists, including young Fidel Castro, who just happened to be in town. You know, a patsy is blamed for killing the popular liberal president. It set off a wave of violence that lasted a decade and basically continued until fairly recently in Colombia. And I mean serious bloodletting, a low-level simmering civil war that just wouldn't stop, with assassinations, disappearances. Something like the like Argentina in the 1970s is also kind of similar. But this is the type of a period that I think that we're going to be going into. And the Scalise shooting and the Las Vegas massacre, I think, are both indicators of the simmering hatred that the left has, that they've been trying to goad the right into punching first or drawing first. You know, when the black hat gunslinger is trying to shoot the sodbuster, you know, he'll insult him and try to get the sodbuster to draw first. Then it's a legal killing because, you know, your mama wears army boots, that kind of thing. Spit on his wife. But it's a matter of staying out of jail and staying out of the hangman's noose for the professional gunfighter. Well, for the left, they've been like that black hat gunfighter. They've been, you know, spitting at us in the sense of, you know, Berkeley free speech being shut down, things like that, hoping and praying that there would be something like, for example, Charlottesville, only with greater casualties. I think they were trying to goad somebody in Charlottesville into doing either a magazine dump or what we saw there, which was sort of a low-level vehicular ramming, which may or may not even have been an intentional, you know, pedestrian ramming. He actually hit a car, not like he didn't just plow through herds of pedestrians. But that's what they're hoping for, so that they can say, so the Civil War, the civil unrest, it began with these evil white right-winger, you know, deplorable, irredeemables clinging to their guns and their Bibles. They started it. Now we're just responding. Well, I think that the Scalise shooter, Hodgkinson, he got tired of waiting. He took a tip from the New York Times about the Republican softball practice and went down there and camped out there at the YMCA and in his van until he finally got his shot. Luckily, he was, had bad timing, bad training, and some very heroic police saved the unarmed Republican congressman. But in Las Vegas, it looks to me like Paddock, whether it was Islamic, which can't be ruled out. I have no evidence of that other than what ISIS is saying. But if he turns out to be another, you know, for example, Bernie Sanders supporter volunteer like Hodgkinson was, that's going to look terrible for the left. And I think that's why they're trying to keep that kind of information concealed and then dribble it out over time, hoping for other major events to happen in the meantime to kind of take our mind off of Las Vegas, you know, to avoid the tsunami of emotion. And something like that, it seems to me that to be in the works.
If I can, I want to comment on what you said earlier. As far as, I don't believe the authorities would be, well, I guess it's not that I don't believe, I just don't see the authorities being quick to cover up an ISIS-inspired attack, but I do agree with you. They would be willing to cover up a more American party line political attack, a motivated attack. They would be willing to cover that up.
It's very common for left wing socialists to convert to Islam. Mm-hmm. Carlos the Jackal being, you know, example numero uno. It's very common, especially for men. A socialist man believes in a male communist. He believes in a totalitarian or authoritarian system where, you know, human decency has nothing to do with it, where you are authorized to force communism on anybody by any means. The ends justify the means. So it's very easy for them to step over to Islam. I think that they would cover up if it was ISIS. I do.
Okay.
And especially if he came from a progressive left-wing background and then converted. That would be the worst case scenario. That would put him in both camps. That would be the Venn diagram, you know, the two intersecting circles, left and Islam put together. That would be total worst case for them. So I don't rule it out. But you know, if you look at the timeline, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist, I don't believe in a fourth floor window that they somehow magically fixed the window. I think all the shooting was done from those two windows, but the shooting was over in 10 minutes. What happened between the 10 minutes and the shooting's over and the scene is declared secured, we have no idea who was in and out of that room in the meantime. You know, by the time of Las Vegas, if this was a suspense movie, by the time the Las Vegas PD SWAT was cleared to go in there, cleared by whom, you know, almost an hour later, that scene could have been sanitized. I mean, not saying that this happened, but if it was I'm a novelist, right? If this is a thriller, then there would be time to drag bodies in, drag bodies out, put weapons down, take weapons out. take out the ISIS flag, for example, or put an ISIS flag in. The timing of it is just, you know, it leads me to wonder, why did it take so long from the last shot to breaching that door? They claim, and this is a lame claim, they claim they methodically went down the hall, knocking on each door, making sure all the civilians were healthy, before the breaching team actually went and blew down the door. Personally, I don't believe that. And remember, if this is a suite or and or connected rooms, you know, with an opening door in the middle, it's possible that there were more than one door. So, you know, which door are they talking about blowing down with explosives? What about the other door? That's why the video, I expect what they're gonna say that the, you know, that the surveillance cameras of the casino had a mysterious lapse.
Yep, they malfunctioned. You know,
there was some mysterious malfunction and none of the video is readable. They'll find it in the evidence room in the FBI headquarters in 100 years underneath of the steel door from the front of Mount Carmel. You know, the Waco door with the bullets going in, not out, which they literally lost. You know, remember, Mount Carmel burned, okay? So there wasn't a lot left except for some melted weapons and melted metal. But the steel doors were found.
And some melted Americans, Matt, but go ahead.
Right, and melted Americans, including a lot of children. But there are pictures of the doors taken out of the ashes, put on a truck. They were lost somewhere between Waco and Washington. And I suspect they were probably pitched off a bridge into the Mississippi River, if you ask me. But yeah, I have no confidence in the FBI anymore. The subtext on their badges used to say fidelity, bravery, and integrity. And now I think that it just stands for faking bogus investigations. And I think that the senior levels of FBI at headquarters, all they care about is political correctness, paycheck, and pension. And I consider them to have no more honor, the men at the headquarters of FBI, no more honor than Stasi agents in East Germany. No more honor than that. And I wouldn't trust them as far as I could throw the J. Edgar Hoover building.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned something about what's taken so long for them to release these different things, from the suicide note to the security tapes of, you know, who came and went from his room in the days leading up to it. And what's interesting about that receipt release that you mentioned for the room service is that it was issued on the 27th, a day before the Las Vegas Sheriff's Department even said he checked into the hotel room. So now right. We have, you know, even a longer stay that we know for sure he was there a day earlier and already checked into his room a day before they said he checked in. And they also, I think it was Tuesday, threw up footage of him in a casino falling in 2011. They had that queued up ready to go. But still no
right.
footage of anything that happened over this weekend.
If Stephen Paddock had ever in his life belonged to a shooting club, the NRA, the Tea Party, or anything like that, we would have already seen 1,000 hours of video of him at every Tea Party rally he ever attended.
Mm-hmm.
But if he was at the Reno anti-Trump rally on August 23rd, and it's a hell of a coincidence, the guy is a dead ringer for him as far as I'm concerned, and he's in the company of a woman who's a dead ringer for Mary Lou. So, you know, I'm just saying, you know, one seems like a coincidence, but two coincidences lining up like that's a little too astronomical for me. And Mary Lou's ex-husband, who is also has the name Danley, is an uber progressive. Yeah, he is, as far as I'm concerned, he's a communist subversive. I would invite people to read my short story called Professor Raoul X. You know, there are people who their niche in life is weaponizing psychotics. You know, when they meet a psychotic, like for example, a James Earl Ray, that's where I derived the name Raoul for the Professor Raoul X piece. James Earl Ray, who is a, you know, a hillbilly kind of loser that I do believe he pulled the trigger and killed Martin Luther King. But I don't believe that he got himself to Canada and to Europe by himself. This is a guy who'd never traveled probably outside of, you know, the South in his life. And here he is, you know, getting himself into Canada and then over to Europe. I mean, it just doesn't match. So I think that there are people who will weaponize, for example, a Hodgkinson. You know, I wonder if Hodgkinson had any nudges. even the guy in Charlottesville, I wonder if he had, you know, who was nudging him. There's been some very interesting investigative video journalism out of the Charlottesville incident, following his Dodge Charger around and looking at the street where the actual ramming later took place. It's very curious. The forensic analysis of that Charlottesville car ramming is extremely curious. There are a lot of, you know, grassy knoll, man with the umbrella kind of things going on in Charlottesville that make you wonder. But yeah, and this is all going sort of integral with false flags and another term that you have to know, which is a cutout. You're never, ever, ever going to find a memorandum, you know, signed Eric Holder or Hillary Clinton, you know, yes, let's lie about Benghazi. Yes, let's dump firearms into Mexico and blame it on the Second Amendment. These guys are very clever. They meet on the tarmac in a Gulfstream, and they don't usually get caught at it. It's meet space, face to face, and there are no notes taken, no memoranda.
So grandkids in golf, Matt, just grandbabies in golf.
But there's never going to be an FBI agent arrested at the scene of any of these things moving evidence. It'll be a contractor who was hired by another contractor, and if the guy's ever arrested, the first thing out will be his psychiatric history and his, you know, being dishonorably discharged from the military. They'll have that ready to go to discredit him. But there'll never be, you know, a CIA or FBI active agent, you know, or officer that's ever, you know, getting dirty in this stuff. It'll be somebody who maybe had an affiliation as a contract officer years ago that they'll deny. But I think that Las Vegas is highly suspicious, but I encourage people, don't go for the stupid stuff. This is where, and I explain, and I really do get into this in my novels, I encourage people to read them. There is something everybody's familiar with called plausible deniability. Well, maybe it was, you know, something from left field that nobody's thought about, but there's another concept I use called probable culpability. You know, if you get an ex-militia guy up in a building holding an SKS rifle with a scope on it outside of the stadium, well, sure, the media is not going to look into it deeply. But in this case of Las Vegas, there's the broken windows. As far as I'm concerned, all the shots came from there. Other shots are echoes. It's very common to have false reports. Remember the white man in the white van when the Muhammad and Malvo snipings were going on. You know, an erroneous radio report can get repeated and take on a life of its own and then be the subject of either conspiracies or false police, you know, incorrect police investigations. But in the case of Las Vegas, please, folks, don't be imagining, you know, huge teams of people. It's not necessary. All the shooting was done from that room. One guy can absolutely bring 20, 25 weapons up to a room. If anybody's been in a big high-rise hotel, they have the luggage carts. You could stick, you know, six weapons cases or igloo coolers or anything else you want in those things and haul them up to your room. It's no problem. The real thing is, where are the videos? This is Las Vegas. This is not some off-strip third tier. This is the Mandalay. Every hotel hallway and stairwell is filmed 24/7, and they've got it, so they know who was in and who was out of that room. And if the fact that they're not releasing any of this, the fact that in terms of the slow roll, the fact that they only used the drunken picture of Stephen Paddock where he's like leaning over with his eyes closed for like the first 3 or 4 days, this is deliberate. You know, they didn't even, somebody had to find like his driver's license finally to get a picture of him with his eyes open for comparison purposes. You know, I don't care how low profile he was on social media. Nobody that's a gambler in Las Vegas wouldn't have tons of pictures of him up, not to mention all the guns that he's bought. And when people say, well, you know, he's been a gun nut for years. Well, in the first 63 years of his life, I think he bought maybe less than 10 guns, because the total number that they're talking about is like in the low 40s. But in the last year of his life, since October of 2016, he bought 33 guns. And something else important that I've only seen a little bit. Sometimes these nuggets come out, and you got to grab these nuggets because you won't hear them often. The reason he was able to get that room was he didn't, and from in a venue for a concert which was sold out for months and months. He bought it from Airbnb. So he, remember, he doesn't care about the cost. He's like the guy that'll buy a last minute Super Bowl ticket and get it because he's willing to pay high dollar. So if you just went to the hotel 2 weeks before this concert and said, I want these rooms facing that concert, you may or may not get them. And you might have a hard time convincing them that you need to switch rooms until you get the right room. But if you're buying basically at auction on Airbnb, you can get the one over Lollapalooza. You can get the one, I think he was looking at a hotel near Fenway Park.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think maybe, I'm not sure if he even went to Lollapalooza, but that's like, you know, fringe counterculture kind of people. When he found the country Highway 91 thing with all these, you know, deplorable, Bible-toting, Trump-voting, you know, irredeemable conservatives, I think that's when he said this is the one that's going to happen. And he was there for like two other days of the concert. So he was waiting for the last night. I'm not sure why. Somebody pointed out, and remember, we're dealing with somebody who probably has severe psychotic issues. Somebody did point out that if you put, and I'm in no way a numerologist, all right, but we're dealing with a psychotic. You know, why pick October 1 instead of September 30th? And it, you can get the it's like 9-1, and then what's the other one? Somebody showed me this, but you can get like a 9-1-1 out of that date, but not out of a September date. But it's. We're digging deep into a very psychotic person. Obviously, we were talking about him, you know, screaming at night. Mary Lou Danley, possibly she's a connection back to Gary Danley. In the Daily Mail today, it said that he was obsessed with Gary Danley recently. I don't know what that means. Was Gary Danley priming him up? Now, I saw a very fascinating minute and a half video, street video from Berkeley from about a week ago, where some Latina girls are goading a black masked, skinny, tall, white Antifa, saying, "You're just a poser. You're just here for, you know, cosplay. If you're really an ally, you've got to go punch a Nazi right now and get arrested." So there's this whole white racial privilege thing, which they're trying to put on us conservatives. But in this racially charged atmosphere, the intersectional allies of color are using white guilt about white privilege among the white Antifas to goad them. You need to prove you're a real ally. Stop talking and get out and do something. Well, I think that Hodgkinson did at the Republican baseball practice. And it's possible that Stephen Paddock did at the country music festival, you know, prove that you're the man. And I think looking at Stephen Paddock, not that I know much about him, only what's in the media, when I think of motives for somebody who's obviously very smart, you know, you don't become a private plane pilot if you're not a thorough, organized planner. You know, this is not your typical marginal, side, you know, the outcast of life, misfit. This is a guy who somehow accumulated real estate holdings in four or five states, including rental properties, was in control enough that he could be a very careful gambler in Las Vegas. Don't know if he was up or down over the course of the last few years, but he obviously didn't have the kind of problem where he, you know, spun out and just lost all of his wealth. You know, I don't know if he was a net loser or a net winner, but he didn't have such a lack of control like you would expect of somebody out of control who would have just gambled until he lost his entire fortune. Very careful man. Several houses, even in Nevada, including in Reno, the site of that rally. So there's a lot going on with this guy, and I wonder if somebody like a Gary Danley, not saying him necessarily, I sure hope that if there are any honorable FBI agents, fidelity, bravery, integrity guys, remember, not paycheck, pension, and PC. If there are any FBI agents like that anymore, and I hope there are, I have known some in the past, I would hope that they are looking into this in order to expose it and not bury it and cover it up, which I suspect that they might be doing. It's very worrisome to me that, for example, you know, the Bannons and Flynns were literally pushed out of the White House to be replaced by, you know, guys like McMaster, real establishment swamp creatures. Before Obama, they were teaching real Islamic history and information. During Obama, they brought Council of American Islamic Relations in to basically purge all of that out of FBI training and federal law enforcement training. Well, it's still not back. So we've still got these deep state swamp federal law enforcement administrators that are more interested in covering up than in exposing. So I have very little faith that the federal law enforcement is going to be honest. And when we do see these dog and pony show interviews, the pressers like last night in Las Vegas, you almost wonder, I'm almost looking at the local police like they're going to be blinking out torture, you know, like Vietnam POWs, like saying things like, okay, now they're letting me have the microphone, they've vetted my script, but I am going to mention things like possible radicalization. That's like a big blinking out torture. There's probably an FBI handler behind him saying, cut, take his mic. This is right out of the USSR. I mean, I can't believe this is America. And even in the era of Trump, it shows how he's the president, but the deep state security apparatus just rolls on like it doesn't even matter.
Matt, I wanted to ask you if you picked up on, and apparently you have, there seems to be some tension between the FBI and the Las Vegas Sheriff's Department. Do you think that the FBI is literally telling the Las Vegas Sheriff's Department, you know, you can't release this, you can't say this, just as you described?
Sure. Absolutely. Okay. National security. I think that it's very likely. It makes no sense to me. It sounds like a couple of men in black in a room said, now, how are we going to explain the hour it took to breach the door? You know, well, how about this? Nah, it's ridiculous. Nah, they'll never buy that. How about, we went door to door and took 5 minutes on each door going down the hall. Mr. Smith, are you okay? Would you like to get your pet out of the room? It doesn't wash. With an active shooter, they don't know if he's alive or dead. They'd have demo on that door within 5 minutes after the security guard was shot. Max, probably 2 minutes. The security guard is shot. They know it's the room. The smoke alarm's going off, which, by the way, seems to be this very methodical planner. One of the only things he missed was that his amount of firing would set off the smoke detector, which if he had ear protection on or was just deafened from the shooting, he may not have even been aware, or his nerves and his senses too overwhelmed to absorb that, what it meant, or to try to just, you know, shoot out the smoke detector. But once it went off, it doesn't matter. They knew which room it was. The security guard goes there. You can hear the firing from both sides of the hall, up floor and down floor. Security guard gets shot, and then it's an hour before they breach the door, and they're saying, well, there was no shooting going on. Well, maybe the guy was, you know, shooting up heroin. Who knows? But he might be, or maybe he ran out of all the loaded magazines he had, and he's busy jamming mags.
Mm-hmm.
You don't wait an hour when a guy just shot a couple thousand rounds out the window to see if he's ready to shoot another couple thousand rounds out the window. That
very true.
Missing time blows my mind. And when they looked at us in the face, at those pressers, like we're effing morons, well, we decided to be very cautious and go down the hallway door by door to make sure everybody was safe before we breached. That's crap. That's total crap. And they would have breached that door within minutes of the security guard getting shot just to stop him from maybe, or how do you know, considering how methodical this guy is, if you want breachers to not get in, apparently he brought in like a drill and a screw gun and screwed the door shut. How do you know he hasn't brought in a steel net, like a cargo net made of steel wire, and he's got it all screwed all the way around the door? You blow the door down and all it does is fall against a big steel net. Now it's like, okay, who's got the bolt cutters to start cutting a steel net? You know, that which buys you another couple minutes if you're shooting out a window. You can't just predict that a guy that's gone to this trouble hasn't figured out a way to barricade the damn door. You know, he might have brought in Kevlar panels in pieces and screwed them with 100 screws across each door. You can't just depend on the breacher getting through and shooting the guy. And you can't just depend on the guy being dead unless they already knew because they're already watching video from inside the room. You know, here's one of my suppositions. Now I'm being a novelist again, okay? I'm not saying this happened. If the guy's filming himself, why? He's filming himself because he thinks it's being sent out of the hotel to somebody else's computer, maybe his own, for a relay to be saved and relayed, if he is an ISIS guy, to relay it to ISIS for the show and tell video. If he's just doing it because he wants to be the most famous, diabolically clever, evil genius of all time, it's so that it can be disseminated without the FBI being able to stop it to a dozen media outlets where he can be, you know, I was smarter than everybody. Take that, FBI. You know, remember his dad on the run for 10 years from the FBI. Take that, FBI. I was smarter than all of you. Well, if he had video inside of the room, I think he planned for it to be disseminated. If people were aware he was in the room, not saying that they were, they might have known he was dead because they're looking at the video.
Right.
Or maybe he wasn't dead. But the fact, that's all conjecture. The fact remains, it's a steaming pile of you know what to say that it took an hour from the security guard getting shot at the door in question for the breachers to be brought up. Who was holding the LVPD breachers back? You know they were raring to go. They weren't like being brought in from the other casinos, sobering up and finding their gear. Those guys are in a van or in a ready room. They're all they got to do is put on the hard plates and go. They would have been, and this is 10 minutes of shooting. You know they're suited up. They're just looking for where it's coming from. They're in the hotel, narrowing it down. 2 minutes, 5 minutes maximum after the security guard is shot, that door is ready to be blown off its hinges. If that door is not being blown off its hinges, somebody held them back. It seems to me.
And I listened to the, the police scanner audio, some condensed versions and some of the full 2 hours. And what it sounds like is, that they did identify, it took them a little bit to identify the room. The security guard definitely helped, but that the Las Vegas Sheriff's Department identified the room. They were pulled back and a SWAT team was brought in, and they're, while some of them, I mean, obviously they could have cleared some rooms out, but their first priority, as you said, is to get, find out where the shooter is. They did that to intercept and take him down. They're not going to be, I mean, they're going to have a team in place blowing those doors down as they're trying to get other people out from, you know, other areas of the hallway.
Even if they don't get the other people out.
Right.
They're going to, remember, these are strong concrete buildings. It's not like if they breach this door, there's shrapnel's going to hit Mrs. McGillicuddy and her poodle down the hall. That's crap. Okay? They're not worried about that. These walls are built like a vault. This is Las Vegas. You know, these are steel doors. These are fire doors. They're strong. So, if it took an hour for them to get to the breacher on the door, I want to know who breached. Was it Las Vegas Police Department, or were those guys put on the leash? Whoa, stop. We got the urgent national security call from Washington, or, you know, from McCabe, who's still running. I think he's still running the FBI. I don't know. It's these swamp lawyers, these swamp creatures. I mean, he was one of the first ones to come out and say, definitely not terrorism. How the heck do you know, mister? You know, unless you're maybe know something more about it than you're telling us. But if there is somewhere in the stairwell, I think that he also bolted or nailed stairwell doors.
Yeah.
They actually came up the elevator. But I think that somewhere in the lobby or somewhere before the breaching team, I'll bet there was practically fist fights between Fed, HRT, like FBI hostage rescue team. They also have like local regional FBI, what they call, they used to call enhanced SWAT. So Las Vegas definitely has an FBI-enhanced SWAT team. So there will be like a little bit of jurisdictional, you know, rank pulling, you know, pecker checking. We outrank you. We're ordering you to stand down, mister. And the Las Vegas guys are probably saying, we know what room it is. We're blowing that door down now. No, you're not. We have to be careful. None of that adds up. The time delay just doesn't make sense. The guy could have been stunned. Let's say he had some moral qualms. He's in the corner in the fetal position, sucking his thumb. Then he decides, the hell with it, I'm going for the gusto. If they say they don't know that he shot himself until they get in the room, and remember, there's also a lot of other things that could have been happening in terms of the I would like to know really the coroner report about time of death, things like that, which can be established. I'll bet that's going to be very fuzzy also. Very fuzzy coroner's report, because they can make it look like a suicide by sticking a pistol in the guy's mouth and shooting him after death for sure. But we don't know any of that. Or the guy might have been trying to surrender. No, no, sir, you're not surrendering. Bang, in the mouth. You know, while he's got his hands up. We may never know, because I don't know yet, was it really LVPD that breached, or was it them being held back while federal enhanced SWAT went in and sanitized the scene in order to not disturb the sheeples out there with the truth of what really happened? You know, and it pisses me off in particular, because for this whole almost a week now since Sunday, white men with guns are being portrayed as evil incarnate, because there's no motive. He's just a white man with too many guns. Well, I'm a white man with some ARs. I was at a range yesterday with a friend shooting ARs. And, you know, it pisses me off to be tarred by the national media and all these, you know, big websites and networks. White men with guns, they're the big problem in America. Well, what if it is actually a progressive lefty who's trying to become famous, you know, give some meaning to his life, and enhance the cause of, you know, world socialism by sliming the Second Amendment? You couldn't do a better thing. It's like a twofer. You get to kill or shoot hundreds of your most hated, evil, Bible-thumping Christian Trump voters, and you get to backfist the Second Amendment out of the way, which is the biggest obstacle to the progressives forcing socialism on everybody. They know that eventually it comes down to socialism being a cram down, not an election, a cram down, you know, for our own good. But they can't do it while they've got that pesky Second Amendment in the way. So think about it. You get to shoot a bunch of your enemies, and then the Second Amendment is blamed. It's perfect. It's beautiful. If you're a lone shooter Paddock that thinks of all these things, or if you are Professor Raoul X, and I encourage people to read that, if you're a Professor Raoul X and you see in a Stephen Paddock the potential, Stephen, when are you going to quit talking about it? When are you going to do something? Your life has meant nothing. So you're a millionaire. You can't fly anymore. Your health is going to crap. You're all paranoid about bugs and germs. Why don't you do something and be an immortal? You'll live forever. You'll be famous. You'll be the man that started the Civil War. So I would really encourage people to look deeply into the motives and the people that might have been instigating and encouraging this guy, if indeed that happened. We don't know that it happened. But I'm telling you, the timeline from the end of the shooting to the breaching stinks like a rotten, I don't know what,
yeah,
in the punch bowl.
And we want to thank, again, we want to thank Bill McIntosh from Ocaso Media for arranging this interview. Matt, we only have a few minutes left. Just want to ask you this. The November 4th Antifa and leftist day of rage that is planned, anything you see that is concerning you, do you think that they will try to carry this plan out and cause disruptions and violence in different cities in America?
I think anybody that's promoting it is hoping for mayhem, is hoping for like a little, helter-skelter, national helter-skelter. But as well, especially after shooting a bunch of, conservative country music fans, I think what they're really hoping for is a magazine dump going the other way now. They're hoping for some veteran or right-winger Tea Party type NRA member to say, that's it, I'm getting revenge for Las Vegas, and I'm going to go to this Antifa rally, you know, with 10 magazines loaded, and I'm going to, you know, waste them the way they wasted my country music brethren. I think that that's almost more of what they're hoping for. Again, it's the black hats that are trying to get the sod buster to draw first. So you could almost say that Las Vegas is like the ultimate instigation. You know, what's it going to take to get you conservatives to fight, you know, to take up arms so that we can then have our civil, you know, our civil disorder and you know, ban rallies, you know, crack down on the internet free speech, all these hate sites. They're instigating violence. So I think they're trying to get something to happen, and I encourage, you know, my conservative, libertarian, right-leaning brothers and sisters, don't go for this. You know, hold your fire, load more magazines, buy another case while you can, because it's all about shaping the battle space. Let it be clear that it's these progressive lefties like Hodgkinson and probably Paddock that are trying to start this kinetically. Don't go kinetic from our side. There'll be plenty of time for kinetic if and when civil war is truly in swing, but don't let it come from our side.
Amen. Absolutely. Amen. Our guest has been Matt Bracken, enemiesforeignanddomestic.com. Again.
Oh, and I do have a new book. This is my best novel.
Yes.
Yeah, I think this is my best book, Red Cliffs of Zerhun. And it's also on Kindle. It's the Kindle covers on the back of the printed book. But it has 4.9 star Amazon reviews. I think it's my best writing. All of my books, I think, have got great stories, but I think I'm a better novelist, a better writer now than I was with Enemies Foreign and Domestic. But
well,
all
Matt,
of my books, I think, are great. But
I'll tell you what, I am going to read Red Cliffs of Zerhun. I do understand there's a child trafficking component to it, and that is certainly salient, certainly germane to what we do day here at the Hagman Report.
Right.
And,
absolutely.
You know, you said it, sir. It is all about shaping the battle space. And our three guests tonight on the Hagman Report, Mr. Matt Bracken, has helped each of us do exactly that. Shape the battle space. Don't buy the BS. Don't draw first. Matt Bracken, God bless you, sir.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night. Well, that will do it for us tonight here at the Hagman Report. Want to remind everybody again out there, don't forget of the two new shows that we have. The Doug Hagman Show, 9 to 10 a.m., and the Hagman Daily Show, 2 to 3 p.m. on Global Star Radio Channel 3, Blog Talk Radio Live and Archive on the podcasting apps, as well as the access to it on HagmanReport.com. And don't forget to bookmark HagmanReport.com as we update it daily with news from curated content to original authors, and that's a great source for information. John, I want to thank you for filling in for my dad again. And tomorrow night we have Dr. Ted Brewer who's going to join us. And I'm not sure if he'll be back for that. He says he will, but we don't know. We'll see what happens. But it's been fun doing the show with you as we do the daily show every day. And we've had a lot of great guests, so thank you.
Well, it's been my pleasure. It's been my honor, as always, to sit in the big chair. Prayers for Doug Hagman as he wades through this investigation in the post-Las Vegas tragedy. Joe Hagman, thank you so much, and God bless each and every one of you.
Yeah, we'll be back tomorrow, and you know, we're going to continue to keep our eye on a number of issues, including Las Vegas. I do suspect between my dad and others out there doing some legwork that something will come out. I hear that there might be another woman in custody or associated with this. Not sure yet, but we'll see, folks. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great night, and God bless.